Hello, seafood friends, and welcome to season two of Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. We're recording our first episode back in beautiful yet breezy Hollywood, Florida, where the Undercurrent team has been reporting live from the National Fisheries Institute's Global Seafood Market Conference.
That's right. Joining us on the pod this week to share some of their key thoughts and takeaways from GSMC 2026 is Undercurrent News founder and editor-in-chief Tom Seaman.
Hello, everyone.
Also joining us today is editorial director Cliff White.
Hey, hey.
We have America's editor Jason Huffman.
What up?
And then from our price reporting team, we have Ben Fisher.
Good afternoon.
And of course, Gary Morrison.
Cheers.
All right. So this year, despite missing some regular faces.
We missed you, James Berger.
GSMC had a record attendance, over 620 attendees for the 13th annual event. And honestly, it's not really hard to see why with everything that's going on in the industry at the moment.
We've got inflation, tariffs, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, more tariffs. So with that, Jason, why don't you kick this off for us?
Coming to the event, I thought this is what everyone would want to talk about, tariffs. And as we were talking here, the idea is kind of maybe there's a little tariff fatigue. Everyone's dealing with it. Do we really need to talk about it all the time? But apparently we do, because it's just this issue just won't go away and it keeps evolving. The latest, of course, is President Trump is now threatening tariffs on 8 different countries that sent military to Greenland to defend against the fear of an invasion by the U.S. And 2 of those countries happen to be major sources of salmon for the U.S., Norway and the U.K. And now the sort of a new reality is hitting, and countries that knew they thought they had their tariff rates down are now looking at higher tariff rates. And this seems to be a perpetuating kind of situation. We never really know what the tariffs are going to be on different countries. My pal Cliff here just interviewed the Norwegian Seafood Council executives and came away with a really good story on how they're responding to the situation. So Cliff, why don't you talk about that?
Sure. So speaking with Christian Kramer, the head of the Norwegian Seafood Council, which is the trade body representing Norwegian seafood industry, he's saying that a $4.4 million campaign to promote Norwegian seafood in the U.S. is in jeopardy because of this latest tiff over Greenland. For the Norwegians, for the Europeans, I think it's more than a tiff. It's always hard to tell how serious Donald Trump is when he's making these outlandish statements, but I think for the countries that are putting troops into Greenland, they are taking it seriously. And looking at what's happening now in Davos with world leaders like Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, and others, Mark Carney, the prime minister of Canada, speaking out in very stark terms against Trump's threats, this is becoming more than just a trade issue. It's becoming a rupture of the global world order. For the Norwegian Seafood Council, the impact is that they are considering pulling out of this campaign altogether, depending on what happens. They haven't made any decisions, but he said he's already had 3 phone calls since he's been here in Florida with the Norwegian industry members talking about whether this campaign is viable anymore in the U.S. They are looking at China as the alternative. So Southeast Asia is another promising market. Europe is potential for growing their salmon sales there, even though Europe is already a big market. The question is, does the current global world order on trade disintegrate because of stuff like this? That's the big question. Is Trump is using trade and tariffs for geopolitical ends, and how is that going to change trade flows in the next week, month, year through Trump's term?
So actually, this is a great way to lead into Tom here. You reported, Tom, that the latest threat in Trump tariffs would benefit Polish salmon processors.
Yeah, so Poland is one of the biggest salmon processing hubs in Europe, and obviously they're not included on this list. So I interviewed on day one Johannes Korf from Norwegian Seafood, which is actually a company based in Holland and not in Norway. And they're one of the major salmon processors in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands and Denmark are on the list. So in addition to Norway and the UK, which are producing salmon, the Netherlands and Denmark are processing large volumes of salmon to value-added products and exporting that to the US. So yeah, he was reasonably concerned about this because it could potentially add, of course, an extra 25%. in two installments, 10 and then 15, and would really benefit Poland because Poland would be still subject to the existing 15% EU tariff. And yeah, on the subject of salmon, it might not be tariff related, so a bit duller, I guess, but the salmon panel was one of the strongest, I think, at the conference, and it really set up production outlook for the rest of the year, with both Norway and Chile forecast to be at best stable, and if not down slightly. I think the forecast for Norway was a drop of 1% to 1.7 million metric tons, with Chile down to about 800,000 metric tons, 1% drop too. Of course, it could be that they exceed this and do increase, but the general consensus was at best production will be stable from those countries, which of course will have a pricing impact. And the figure they were presenting was 17 and 25% average increase in salmon price in 2026, which will be very interesting if that does happen. And then when you throw tariffs on top of that, the whole thing is going to be quite interesting to see how it unfolds.
So as the price reporter in charge of the wild salmon market, my ears perked up a little bit during the panel when they started touching on wild salmon. So the estimate is that wild salmon made up about 15% of global supply last year, with the remainder obviously being farmed salmon. And I think a lot of people consider farmed and wild salmon to be in competition with each other. But on the panel, it was pointed out that maybe we shouldn't think about it that way. And that's because that given the lion's share of wild salmon catch in odd years, at least, that's pink salmon, which is being used in canned formats and value-added products. Well, that's not competing with farmed salmon. And you have chum salmon, which is used for its roe and also for secondary processing, certainly not fillets. That's not competing with farmed salmon. Even sockeye, one of the two premium wild species, a lot of that is used for canning. Somebody on the panel said that they walked out of the conference hotel down the street to Publix and found some canned sockeye salmon on the shelves there. So ultimately, you have king salmon, a tiny percentage of the total wild catch, a little bit of coho, and then some sockeye salmon, which are the only two that are actually in competition with farmed salmon in grocery store cases as fillets and as portions. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at the two salmon markets.
Yeah, you brought up canned salmon, and that was something that I've been eyeing as I cover the retail space a lot. And canned salmon, nothing's going to be canned tuna, but canned sardines has overtaken canned salmon as the dominant choice, of course, like I said, excluding tuna. But what I also thought was interesting during the panel is that, there's all this excitement building around sardines, but they were saying that Alaska, there's so much uncertainty with all the mergers and acquisitions going on with Silver Bay having all the big acquisitions since 2023, that there's just a lot of uncertainty right now regarding that. So I thought that was interesting because seeing that there is a trend there, that all you have to do is like kind of just turn to TikTok. You have to just the way you market it has to be a little bit different, but they're not really sure if they can even take that route and compete really again with sardines with so much uncertainty in that space. So I thought that was interesting. Now, Lauren, let's talk cod.
Let's do it. So one of the biggest themes that we're seeing right now, and it really cuts across whitefish species, is that pricing power is being set upstream. So even though demand right now isn't really running hot, the markets are staying firm because of those replacement costs and the constrained supply landscape that we have right now. That's especially evident in driving those Atlantic cod prices here in the U.S., raw material values, especially out of Barents Sea into China, remain historically high, and that pressure translates well throughout U.S.-bound twice-frozen product forms. Some of the panels, they were talking about substitution, and that puts extra focus on Pacific cod. Ben, if you want to jump in there.
Yeah. So traditionally, east of the Mississippi, particularly in New England, consumers have been accustomed to Atlantic cod for historical and maybe somewhat nostalgic reasons due to the commercial fishery once being there. But since we've seen this huge run-up in Atlantic cod prices, there's been more and more species substitution as Pacific cod pricing lags Atlantic cod. And this substitution is not only due to price, but also to availability with quota cuts and a ban on Russian fish. But in my price reporting on Pacific cod raw material pricing, I'd heard that consumers on the east coast of the U.S. were quite particular about their cod and that Pacific cod was not much of a hit there. But now one whitefish panelist said that customers are getting more and more used to Pacific cod, and in some cases that switch over from Atlantic to Pacific in grocery store cases is becoming permanent.
Now, we've covered a lot. We still have a lot to go, so we're gonna keep on here. Shellfish, all right? Jason, you're our guy here. And there's been a lot going on. Unfortunately, we have Barb Dean Simmons, who wasn't at the conference with us, but she's been covering everything from the home front, so we have, like, a lot to bring back to her from this conference.
Oh, yeah. There was a ton of stuff. So I was at the Shellfish panel yesterday. So was Tom, and we kind of blogging from it. And it was a really informative session. Do you want to go bad news or good news first?
Oh, no, let's get out of the way. Let's hit me with bad news.
Good, because I was going to do bad news first anyhow. So if you've been reading our publication recently, you know that snow crab supply is kind of running out of gas. There's a particular size that's very popular, 5 to 8s, and it's really hard to find them, and the prices are going up as a result. The new season in Canada doesn't start for another couple months, so we're kind of in a position where we could really use some more snow crab. And one of the speakers on the panel was talking about the fisheries that are really driving the snow crab market in the U.S. because we don't have Russia anymore. Russian seafood's been banned. We have Norwegian and we have Canadian. The Canadian's like 80, 90% of it. So he reported that he's hearing anecdotally that the quotas in those two major fisheries in Canada are going to be down 12 to 13%. And that means like about 20 million pounds less snow crab next year. So knowing what we know now about how we're kind of running out of the snow crab supply, record imports this year, then next year is probably going to be pretty tight as we head into it. Now, we were waiting for the Canadian authorities, the DFO, to report what those quotas are going to be. And we might not get this until March, but that's where we are right now.
So, Jason, yeah, it's a great panel, right? And, I mean, you talked about, you know, Russia takes out the big sizes, right?
Right.
But now we're seeing the supply constraints on the 5 to 8 ounce clusters, and that's really driving prices up. We've seen record prices here historically on some of these sizes, but a 20 million pound reduction in quota or 13% is going to be pretty significant. So these guys in the industry seem to think that there's a price floor set at these elevated levels, and if you know demand stays where it's at, that you know prices are only going to stay here or move higher.
And if you're interested in keeping tabs on the prices of snow crab, Gary's the guy to pay attention to because he's got that stuff in front of him all the time.
Hit us with the good news, all right? Let's
do the good news?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there were two items I noted as good news. I'll start with lobster. As you might recall, Canada has confronted a 25% tariff from China. And China has been gradually weaning itself off of Canadian lobster and moving into other directions. Not U.S. lobster. They're taking in warm water lobster from Vietnam and Australia. And the Canadians are just losing a major market for themselves. So just recently, a trade deal was struck between Canada and China that gets rid of the tariff starting in March. And because the drop in imports of Canadian lobster to China have been kind of gradually leading up to the tariff, there was some concern that maybe that wouldn't even change the trend. But one of the speakers on the panel said that he's getting calls already from Chinese buyers who are like, set me up. I'm ready to buy Canadian lobster again. So fingers crossed, it sounds very positive for Canadian lobster. The other issue that came up was in the crab meat conversation. Bryce Phillips from Phillips Food was there, and he's also the chairman of the NFI Crab Council. And he recounted how back on Labor Day, they got the news that some of their fisheries were going to be banned from entering the U.S. for MMPA reasons, Marine Mammal Protection Act reasons. The country's fisheries had to say they met the same standards as they have in the U.S. And five of the 240 to-be-banned fisheries were crab meat fisheries. So and it was like 90, 95% of the supply to the U.S. So they started freaking out. And they turned around, though. They got themselves together. They filed a lawsuit with the U.S. Court of International Trade that led to a settlement with NOAA. NOAA gave them more time. This week was the deadline to reapply for comparable standards. And Bryce is under the understanding that all of the fisheries they were involved with have got their new applications in. So they're there. The bad news is Venezuela is not part of this effort, and we will not see Venezuelan blue crab for a long time.
Hey, Jason, can I play devil's advocate with your good news on lobster?
No.
So if Canadian lobster starts going to China again in decent quantities, that's going to pose a real problem to U.S. wholesale prices. hard-shell live lobster in the U.S. for chicks, that's 1 pound or 1 1/4 pound, that rose about 15% this week, and that's before China started getting a bunch of Canadian lobster. I think a lot of lobster dealers in the U.S. are actually quite petrified of this news because that creates a lot of competition in the U.S. for that Canadian lobster supply.
Well, that's the nature of seafood, man. It's good news for one group, bad news for another. It's always that way. I choose the good news part of it.
Fair enough.
All right, so one of the things that I was keeping an eye out for when it came to shrimp was, I'm like, you have to talk about what's going on in Indonesia, right, at the moment. I'm like, I was just really curious about that as I've been following the CS-137 contamination since August. And we got to hear from John Woody, NFI's chief science officer, and I was surprised to hear that, or maybe I wasn't surprised since we just had a recall in December, but he said that, you know, this Indonesian shrimp, the import alerts from the FDA, it's going to remain in place for the foreseeable future. Right now we have two import alerts that are affecting Indonesian shrimp. You have import alert 9951, which is just firm specific. That's BMS Foods, the one firm that had the contaminated shrimp, essentially bans all shrimp imported from that company. But then there's 9952 import alert, and that's shipment by shipment. And they turn to Indonesia's Marine and Fisheries Quality Assurance Agency to approve each shipment. And like I said, Woody said that, you know, that's going to remain in play for quite some time. Gary, what are your further thoughts on shrimp?
Yeah, I mean, for that specific topic, I think the biggest impact is shipment times. It takes a lot longer for shrimp from Indonesia to get to the United States now than it has in the past. They do have to go through the certification. That's causing, you know, larger lead times to get here to the U.S.
Yeah, one of the panels was talking about, yeah, just the containers that are just sitting, the delays coming in. But what were your other key takeaways from the shrimp panel?
So the biggest takeaway, I think we've been talking about, if you've been reading, you know, some of our, you know, stories and articles, is global production continues to rise. So the industry is going to be tasked with finding customers for that increased product, right? And it's being driven largely by Ecuador. We saw it here for the U.S. during COVID, where they were kind of forced to find a new partner. And now they're making a concentrated effort to continue to grow market share here. They've been investing in plans to meet the needs of the U.S. consumer for value-added peeled and deveined shrimp. And they're going to continue to do so. And we're starting to see you know, how that's impacting prices here in the U.S. We started seeing some of the Latin prices start to come off a little bit here in the U.S. Just because of the increase in imports that we saw as of the last trade data. Actually, it was the first time in 10 years that Ecuador shipped more shrimp to the United States than India. India has traditionally been our number one trade partner with about 40% of market share. So, you know, that was a significant revelation when we saw that trade data.
All right, well, that's almost about our time, but I just want to kind of do a pass around, your final thoughts from the show. I know one thing I had to address, because it's just everywhere right now, is the GLP-1 trend. It's an opportunity for the industry to address inflation. That's what Anne-Marie Roering said, which I thought was really interesting, because, you know, it's these medications, they're curbing your cravings, but they're saying it's a way to shift portion sizes. So you have health top of mind, but it also provides an opportunity to move the needle on seafood sales. So I thought that was, you know, something that I'm going to keep an eye on moving forward. Lauren, any final thoughts?
Yeah, one thing that I saw repeated over and over is that substitution is narrowing across species. Whitefish is no longer, you know, a substitution ladder. Cod and haddock prices are out of control. And, you know, we're also seeing that with scallops. We're not getting any relief from imports on the domestic front. So buyers have to be the buzzword nimble. You know, they still have options, but those options come with a trade-off, whether that's size or origin or product form.
I think we could have made a drinking game yesterday with the amount of times I heard the panelists say nimble.
Right, right.
Can I say the word nimble again?
Sure.
Because I just got to, I mean, hey, we may be tired of talking about it, but it's not tired of us yet, tariffs. I think we just have to kind of keep an eye on them. They're just, hey, the Supreme Court might rule soon. We might lose the tariffs. They might stick around. We don't know. But either way, this is an ever-changing game.
Shifting gears a bit, I thought that the call to have seafood in chicken restaurants was fun. You have all these chicken restaurants that are serving seafood. Why shouldn't it be the other way around? I look forward to a pollock sandwich at Chick-fil-A.
I think the big takeaway for me was around the uncertain future of Atlantic cod in the U.S. market. I cover the raw material pricing on that, which has been rocketing up past $10,000 per metric ton since last October, but that hasn't hit the U.S. market yet. So it was really interesting to be here at the conference and speak to, you know, major U.S. importers about their perspective, because this raw material price won't filter through to finished products that have come to the U.S. until Q2. So then we'll kind of see the real impact of this, you know, record high raw material, and we'll see the level of demand destruction that it causes. And at some point, you know, the demand will drop off to an extent more than the supply, which will maybe cause the pricing to correct. You know, a source of mine said the best solution to high prices is high prices, and we'll see how that plays out with cod this year.
Well, you mentioned prices, and I think for me, the most fascinating part of this show was learning more about the state of the U.S. economy and where the mindset of U.S. consumers are at. Christian Lawrence from Rabobank gave a really good macroeconomic overview where he presented a pretty compelling case for a K-shaped U.S. economy, where you have the top 10% of U.S. consumers accounting for 50% of spending. And then, yeah, so you can see the alternative. And he was saying, there's a portion of consumers that think a $40 seafood boil is a good deal. And then there's a portion of consumers that say $10 for a pollock sandwich is too much, or whitefish sandwich. And so I think with replacement becoming harder to find, with prices going up on so many across so many species, the U.S. seafood industry really needs to find where its niches are, where it can continue to succeed with consumers, and what battles are kind of lost at prices where they are right now. That was really the most interesting thing as we go into the 2026 season with a crazy political situation. I think geopolitically a lot happening. The U.S. market is still the biggest seafood market in the world. How it's going to change is really what I'm keeping my eyes on for the next year.
Well, I think for me, I don't know if you guys can all agree, but I think on the panel, I think I'm the most optimistic one in most things. But from what I see, it's the seafood industry has a huge opportunity, whether it's from the GLP-1s that Amanda talked about, whether it's about the new nutritional pyramid that was flipped upside down, where they're talking about seafood and protein as a major part of people's diets now, or like Captain D's, where meeting their consumers where they are, where they're thinking about concepts that traditionally they would not have thought about in the past, because that's what the consumers want. So I think
they're finding great success. She mentioned they had their first walk-up location, and they opened it in New York, which is actually their first East Coast location too. So that's a big change. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's opportunity out there to increase seafood consumption, despite all the outside noise. And I think that's, you know, my biggest takeaway from the conference so far.
Well, I wasn't expecting Gary to be the little ray of sunshine to end this episode, but here we are. So thank you so much for listening. We got more coverage coming from GSMC leading into next week. And Catch the Current is back every Friday. So if you're not subscribed, subscribe now. All right. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. 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 Cheers.